John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network. Could there be a relationship between rising income inequality and rising political polarization? A new study using new methods of analysis concludes that there is, in fact, a link between our increasing political dysfunction and the growing gap between the 1% and the rest of the population. We're going to talk about that research and what it means today on the Kathleen Dunn Show. And as always, your participation is not only welcome, but crucial. Join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Post a comment or question on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page or send an email to talk@wpr.org. My guest this hour is Nolan McCarty, professor of politics, Princeton University, and one of the authors of a study titled Unequal Incomes, Ideology and Gridlock, How Rising Inequality Increases Political Polarization. Professor McCarty, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Hi, thank you.
Okay, so we've heard a lot. I mean, there's plenty of news about political dysfunction and the growing gap between the rich and poor. There's been some suspicion over the years that these two things are somehow related. Your research, however, says that they are, in fact, related. Was there some sort of smoking gun that you discovered? What's the link between income inequality and political dysfunction?
Sure. So one of the reasons why political scientists such as myself have been worried about the link between income inequality and polarization for some time is that if you look at the history of the United States, it tends to be the fact that we observe the most partisan conflict, the most polarization during exactly those periods in which economic inequality is the highest, where the disproportionate amount of the economic gains goes to the top part of the income distribution. The problem with that, of course, is that it's very, very hard to establish causality. We don't know if our current period is both polarized and unequal because polarization causes inequality, or because inequality causes polarization, or because there's some third factor that's causing both of them. So for a very long time, we've been uncertain about, you know, what causes what and whether there's any real systematic relationship. So to get at that, my colleagues and I have spent the past dozen years or so collecting data on voting in state legislatures as a way of getting measures of polarization for each of the 50 states. And then once we have those measures, we can link that with the changes in income inequality in each of the states. And so instead of one observation of nationally high inequality and polarization, we have 50 observations over the past 20 years to look at the question. And when you look at the richer, larger data set and do some other things to kind of ensure that it's not spurious, we do find a pretty substantial impact such that as income inequality rises, polarization in state legislatures also rises.
So in terms of the chicken and egg argument, if you will, the income inequality comes first and then the dysfunction?
So I want to be a little careful. There's also ways in which polarization causes income inequality. We haven't ruled those out, but so it is possible that there's a cycle such that income inequality produces polarization, which then in turn produces income inequality. But this particular study has only looked at one part of that cycle, and that's the impact of income inequality on polarization. And we've kind of got at the chicken and egg part by focusing on the parts of inequality that are changing in the states that are not affected by state policies. So there's a certain component of the increase in inequality in a state that's caused by national level factors. So we focused on that. So we're pretty sure that it's the income inequality causing the polarization, not something that each state's government is doing to increase income inequality.
Mm-hmm. And you also point out in your research and the various articles that have been published about it that Interestingly enough, efforts to relieve income inequality, things, policies that would tend to restore some of the balance in income, are not popular. I mean, there's no, you know, huge groundswell. That just seems counterintuitive. Do you have an explanation for that phenomenon?
Yeah, that's right. So one of the things that's been somewhat puzzling to scholars is that we typically think, say, going back as far as Aristotle, that democracy and democratic processes are ways of addressing income inequality. The idea is that when incomes become more equal, it means that a few people are getting richer faster or than most people, or some people are getting richer and some people are getting poorer. But in any case, in a democracy, the more people should be able, through the ballot box and other democratic mechanisms, to kind of rectify that situation. But we've not seen that happen in the contemporary United States, whereas arguably it has happened in Western Europe and other developed democracies. The U.S. was not terribly more unequal than Sweden in the 1950s and 60s. But for whatever reason, the same forces that generated income inequality in the U.S. were arrested through political processes in Sweden and not in the United States. So part of the big puzzle is why there's been such a lack of reaction to increasing inequality in the U.S. And scholars have lots of hypotheses about why that's the case, ranging from the political culture of the United States being anti-statist and not wanting government intervention even for plausibly worthwhile things like arresting inequality, to the role of corporations, campaign contributors, et cetera. So it is quite a mystery, and the United States is actually somewhat unique in that its response to rising inequality has been much less aggressive than it was in other developed countries.
And these other countries, a different attitude toward government than in the U.S.? I mean, we had Ronald Reagan running pretty much on a platform that said the government isn't the solution, it's the problem, and if we get government out of the way, we'll all be more prosperous. Did we not see that happen elsewhere in the world, or at least if we did, it wasn't successful?
It varies in different parts. I mean, obviously, in Britain, there was kind of a parallel trend with the election of Thatcher, and so Britain is one of those countries in which inequality grew more. But in many countries, the social safety net expanded to accommodate trends like globalization, increased trade, the demographic factors, which increase inequality. So part of the difference is obviously, I think the U.S. U.S. citizens are more mistrustful of government, even if they believe, even if they'd like redistribution. I think there's an American belief that the government won't do it very well, or they'll redistribute it to the wrong people. So that's part of the U.S. story. Probably culturally, the U.S. is more tolerant of inequality than citizens in other countries, and so there was a stronger normative push to do something about it in other countries. But in my research, I've tended to focus on the political processes, and there I think that the impact that inequality's had on polarization in America is really important. Because in our constitutional system, with separation of powers and vetoes and filibusters, it's very hard to make public policy unless there's a very strong consensus for doing so. And the fact that the American public is polarized on issues of economic distribution at the same time things are becoming more unequal, it made it much, much harder for government to act, and the result is that for the most part, the government didn't act in the same way that other countries did, and incomes got much more unequal.
I would like to invite our listeners to join us again, and the number is different today. Kathleen Dunn is gone today, and she's also gone on Monday. I'll be filling in for her. We have a different number than the usual one, so I want to give that again and the other information about how to get in touch. 800-642-1234. That's a toll-free number that's good pretty much wherever this program can be heard, although I understand it doesn't work from Australia. 800-642-1234. You can also post your comment or question to the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page or send us an email. The address is talk@wpr.org. We have Nolan McCarty with us talking about the connection between income inequality and our political dysfunction here in America, wondering what you think. Chris is with us from Beaver Dam. Let's go to the phones. Chris, good afternoon. Thanks for being here.
Good afternoon. Great show. My comment is that income equality is actually more of a political thing than an actual economic reality. In America, because we have sufficient income mobility, and the income mobility has stayed the same, relatively stayed the same since World War II, income equality may, inequality may have grown, but the same number of people are moving into and out of different income classes over time, and that is actually a much greater effect than in Western Europe, where you have a lot of chronic unemployment and stagnant income mobility, where we are the land of opportunity, and should you desire, no matter what the present economy is, there is opportunity to go and make your own wealth.
Professor, what do you make of Chris's comment?
So, is kind of a factual matter in terms of the studies which have studied differences in economic mobility between the United States and other countries. The United States is not an exceptionally mobile country. There obviously are plenty of success stories where people rise out of poverty or near poverty and become wealthy, and stories about people who start out being quite wealthy and become impoverished. That does happen, but it doesn't seem to happen that much more often than it does in other Western European countries. So, by objective measures, there's not exceptional amount of social mobility in the U.S. Some would argue there's somewhat less. Some would argue there's a little more. You know, I tend to think it's about the same. But I think what's very important about the politics of inequality is that Americans believe that there's great opportunity in social mobility. So one of the reasons why there's been a lack of a political movement, at least before, you know, perhaps before Senator Sanders entered the presidential race, is that, you know, Americans believe that they do have an opportunity to get wealthy, and government is one of those things that might stand in the way of that. And so it's another reason why people are hesitant to call upon the government to redistribute income.
Mm-hmm. Chris, thanks so much for the call. We're going to take a break here, and when we come back, we'll continue our discussion with Nolan McCarty, professor of politics at Princeton University. He is one of the researchers of a study titled Unequal Incomes, Ideology and Gridlock, How Rising Inequality Increases Political Polarization. We're talking about how those things are related and what the research found. When we come back, Professor, I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier about the focus of your study in the state legislatures and what you found there. Maybe we can dig into a few of the details. Again, you are invited to join the discussion at any time this afternoon at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. That's a different number than the one you usually use for Kathleen Dunn's show. So I'll give it one more time, 800-642-1234. Of course, the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page is open for your comments and questions all the time, and you can also send us an email. The address is talk@wpr.org. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn today. You're listening to this program on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we're talking about the relationship between income inequality and political dysfunction. My guest is Nolan McCarty, professor of politics at Princeton University, and one of the authors of a new study that makes a link between these two concepts. We've been talking about that this afternoon, and we'll continue to do that for the rest of the hour. You're invited to participate at 800-642-1234. Professor, we touched on this, but we didn't really get into the details, and I don't want to get into too far into the weeds on this, but your study focused on the state legislatures and how they're moving to the right, and that's furthering the political divide. So if state legislatures are moving to the right, then the voters put them there. How did that work?
Yeah. So, to be clear, what we found was that polarization was increasing in the states, both because Republican parties become more conservative as income inequality rises, and Democratic parties become more liberal as income inequality rises. But as you suggested, there was also a kind of a third surprising effect, which is that as income inequality rose, Republicans were being more successful in winning elections in those states. And it's a bit of a mystery when you think about the way we traditionally think about the politics of inequality, which suggests as inequality goes up, there should be greater demands for government intervention and therefore perhaps benefiting the party of the left. To be honest, we don't really know why that inequality has had this kind of conservative effect, why it's sort of biased state legislatures in a more conservative direction. A leading hypothesis, if you will, would have something to do with kind of the role of campaign contributors and campaign finance in the state. If you think about the impacts of inequality, it should make high-income voters more conservative, lower-income voters more liberal. Typically, the lower-income voters participate through their votes, and higher-income voters participate through their votes and through their contributions. So the hypothesis would just simply be that the votes plus contributions has swamped the votes at the lower end of the income distribution and has really helped kind of move these state legislatures to the right.
And there's been a lot of discussion that following 2010, for example, that gerrymandering has a lot to do with where we are today. But your study sort of it challenges that idea.
Yeah. So this particular study doesn't focus very much on gerrymandering, whether gerrymandering has had an effect in helping the Republicans or in polarizing. Doesn't really affect the study because we don't say that there's nothing going on except for income inequality. We just don't focus on it.
Mm-hmm.
But other studies that I've done, that others have done, have sort of suggested that gerrymandering may not be as big a deal as many people think. One of the things that's important to remember, if you think about polarization in the country as a whole, the United States Senate, which of course has never been gerrymandered because there's two senators per state, shows almost identical levels of partisanship and polarization as the U.S. House. And then if you drill down and look at the House elections, there's very little evidence that gerrymandering has polarized the House. Most of the difference between Democrats and Republicans in legislatures is not that they represent different types of districts. It's that they represent the same sorts of districts in very, very different ways. So gerrymandering is not a huge part of the overall polarization story. Where gerrymandering might have more of a story for recent politics is, of course, after the 2010 election, which was a landslide in favor of the Republicans. Republicans controlled many more state legislatures and therefore got to draw the lines. And so the more interesting question, which I think is still open, is the extent to which the Republicans in the state legislatures created a larger Republican bias in congressional elections and state legislative elections. The reason why we're still uncertain about that is that the Republicans have a natural bias in legislative elections to begin with, because Democratic voters tend to be much more geographically concentrated into cities. Republican voters tend to be more spread out through suburbs and more rural areas. And so if you kind of just draw districts in kind of a natural, compact, and contiguous way, you're going to produce a large number of very, very Democratic districts and cities, which has the effect of wasting Democratic votes, which in turn produces a Republican bias. Mm. So sorting out whether this geographic bias or this political bias is bigger is something that political scientists argue about. So gerrymandering may have produced a little bit of a Republican advantage, but it's probably not the underlying cause of polarization in most states.
I want to come back to that point, but we have full phones, and I want to make sure we give everybody a chance to have at it on this topic. Jake is with us next from Oshkosh. Jake, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. The reason I'm calling is I attend the University of Wisconsin-Oshkosh graduate studies course, Applied Economics and Public Administration, and your guest study is actually on my agenda for a class presentation on October 31st.
So we're helping you with your homework today? Is that what this is?
You have it exactly right.
Glad to be of service. We are an educational institution. We're part of the UW after all, so have at it.
And I've got the article in front of me, actually on my laptop. And is there anything the guest could add to the article at this time? And I'll take the response off the air.
And I think, Jake, didn't you had a question that involved a word that I actually had to look up called externalities. Could you maybe, before the professor answers,
sure,
could you maybe go to that part of it? What was it you were after there?
That is actually the class presentation that I'm doing. The article, the title of the article, What the Externalities and Effects Are on Government Policy as a Result of the Research Done by the Guest. So the actual presentation is on what's called externalities. It's a tough word. and effects on government policy. That's the actual title of the presentation.
Right. I take the question to be along the lines of, you know, what are the kind of political impacts, or what an economist or political economist call the externalities of income inequality? How does income inequality produce negative or even positive impacts on the political system? So I don't know if this is directly related to the question, but I think this is kind of central to thinking about economic inequality in the U.S. I think there's a normative view in the United States that economic inequality is okay as long as the people who are successful have, in some sense, legitimately earned it, and that perhaps the people who are not as successful weren't as successful because they didn't work as hard, or they chose to focus energies elsewhere. So that's a typical view, is economic inequality can be okay if it's a result of kind of reasonable individual choices. Where the externality comes in is that income inequality doesn't stop at the economic sphere. It carries back over into the political sphere, creates, as I've talked about in the paper, kind of polarized politics. It also distorts the campaign finance system because higher income people participate financially much more than low income people. And that in turn impacts the sorts of policies that state legislatures and national legislatures adopt in ways that benefit the contributors and the high income individuals. So the externality of economic inequality is kind of a dysfunctional politics, which is both polarized and inefficient, and also biased toward the interest of high-income citizens.
You know, I'm wondering how the MLA style manual would handle radio interview citations. That might be a question for another broadcast. Jake, good luck. Good luck there at UW Oshkosh. Thank you. Thank you for the call. Let's go to Milwaukee next. George is with us this afternoon. George, good afternoon.
Yeah. Hi. I wonder if the guest is familiar with an article that came out about 4 years ago by Michael Norton from Harvard Business School and Dan Ariely from Duke. It was titled Building a Better America, One Wealth Quintile at a Time. What they did basically was they asked people what kind of a society, one question they asked was, how much wealth inequality is there in the United States? And they found out that people vastly underestimated it. And then the second part of it was, what do you think an ideal society would be? And it was very interesting because across all demographic groups, even among Republicans and the wealthy, desired a more equal distribution of wealth than the status quo.
Yes, I am familiar with that study. I mean, there are others, and this is a really important aspect of politics, which is that income equality, unlike many other policies, is in some sense an abstraction. Policy like whether or not your road in front of your house has been repaved or not, you can verify easily whether it's been done or not and hold the government accountable for whether they did or not. Income inequality, it's hard to know whether things are getting better or worse or how bad they are, what the status quo looks like compared to what you view that it should be. So the fact that these studies like Norton and Ariely's find that people don't really have a good grasp on how unequal wealth and income are distributed, and don't have various interpretations of how it should be. I mean, it's very, very hard to hold politicians accountable for changes in income distribution. So that's a really important part of the puzzle: is that many voters find income inequality to be an abstraction that they have a very hard time getting a mental grasp of.
And George, thank you so much for that call. One of the other things that seems to be happening, and I think you point this out in your research and in some of the writings about the research, is that we've been rather focused politically on a lot of non-economic issues, the issues surrounding things like gay marriage, abortion, a lot of stuff, crime, drugs, a lot of issues that aren't directly tied necessarily in people's minds to the economy. There's certainly a relationship to some of these, but we haven't. You mentioned Senator Sanders. We really haven't had candidates who've been running on an income inequality platform. We've mostly seen a lot of money spent promoting various social issues over the last 30 years. Is that part of what's going on here?
I think that's some of it. I do think sometimes that there's a tendency to kind of underestimate the impact that issues like economic growth, equitable growth, income inequality have on elections, because rhetorically we see a lot less of it. For reasons that I just discussed, sometimes I think it's easier for the media to cover issues like gay rights, the environment, and so forth, than income inequality because of the abstractions involved. But that said, obviously, a lot of the political discourse is focused on issues other than income inequality. A big part of that, I think, though, is caused by economic inequality. If you look at the very wealthiest donors, they're not all, as we all know, they're not all conservative Republicans. There are many people on the left who give money for a wide variety of causes, from the environment to gay rights, to criminal justice reform, or whatever. So a lot of the agenda of elections is dictated by the divergent views of wealthy liberal contributors and wealthy conservative contributors. And they tend to divide much more on issues, on the social issues, environmental issues, than they do on the economic issues. And so because there's been so much inequality and the political system has become so skewed toward the interests of the top 1%, those are the debates that we end up seeing, the things at which billionaires disagree about. We don't see enough of debate on the things that billionaires tend to agree upon, which is less regulation, lower taxes, et cetera. So the the observation that the political system is really focused on a set of non-economic issues, I would actually argue, is caused by the increase in inequality and how it's affected the political system.
Mm-hmm. We have a comment from Bernie in Elkhorn, who commented on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. He writes, inequality exists because political power helps create it. Corporate wealth and control of the political process leads to legislation such as fair trade deals, tax breaks for corporations, etc., that in turn lead to inequality. Well, that would certainly agree with what you've said here this afternoon.
Yeah, I think that's right. One of the things that's really tricky, I think, in talking about income inequality is that on one hand, there's a large amount of income inequality that's just purely generated by the market. If we had this kind of idealized free market, that would generate substantial amounts of income inequality. It would be something that we should be concerned about, perhaps, and the proper response is to have government do something about it. But as your listener points out, a fair amount of income inequality, especially when it pertains to the concentration of income in the top 1%, is caused by government and their hyper-responsiveness to the interests of wealthy individuals. And so I complained before that we hadn't seen enough redistribution in the United States. Actually, you could say we've seen plenty of redistribution in the United States, just much of it is upwards.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones again. Ann is with us from Manawa this afternoon. Ann, good to have you with us. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm just wondering really quickly what other countries do to address that income inequality. Do they have policies or strategies? And sort of wondering what those are. So I can take my answer off the air.
Sure. If you look at the countries of Western Europe, which are the most directly comparable to the United States, there are lots of reasons why they have less observed income inequality. One is they have very strong labor union movements, and so labor unions and their strength tends to tamp down on income inequality, at least within wages. Sometimes having heavy unions lead to more people who are unemployed, might have overall increase in inequality, but at least among those who are employed, unions lead to less inequality. There are much more regulations on labor markets and so forth, and then also much higher taxes, and not higher taxes just on the rich. This is something that's been debated in the last few weeks in terms of Senator Sanders' platforms. But the countries of Western Europe, especially Scandinavian countries, have very high taxes on almost everyone. But in return, they're provide much more public services in return for that. So many of the less or the more equal countries of Western Europe, the government is just taxing a lot more and providing a lot more services. And that tends to keep income inequality down, or at least consumption inequality down. So those are the main differences between the United States and, say, Denmark, which has been much discussed in the last couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm. Anne, thanks so much for the call. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we have a lot more phone calls to get to, and I think I've got about four more pages of questions. Obviously, we won't get to all of those. Fascinating discussion this afternoon on the Kathleen Dunn Show about the relationship between income inequality and our political dysfunction here in the United States. My guest, Nolan McCarty, a professor of politics at Princeton University, and his colleagues have done a lot of study on this, and they say there's a direct link between the two. Wondering what you think. 800-642-1234. If you get a busy signal, go to the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page and leave your comment or question there. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we're talking about the relationship between income inequality and our political dysfunction here in the United States. And we're doing that with Nolan McCarty, professor of politics at Princeton University, one of the authors of a study that links these two things. We have a lot of people on the phones who want to talk about this. Let's start with Fritz in Brookfield. Fritz, good afternoon.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Fascinating study, and I don't disagree with the underlying premise one bit. I believe that income inequality does contribute to the souring of the political discourse in America, but I think I would say it's caused for different reasons. I think it's caused because income inequality is so often related, or it's made synonymous to income unfairness. And those two things are completely different. So there's this idea that just because a certain person makes more money than someone else, that that's necessarily unfair. And that's the way it's characterized, or it's characterized as if somebody makes more, they're necessarily taking from somebody else. And so in effect, you're really it's really seen as the rich stealing from the poor, which is, I just simply fundamentally disagree with that. And so the solution is often posed that you just have to redistribute the income and that the government has to step in. But then you're messing with a person's livelihood. And as Guido on the movie Risky Business said, never mess with a man's livelihood. It's very personal. And that ultimately becomes political. And so I'd be interested in your comments on that.
Sure. I think you're right about a lot of things here. So one is that the notion of fairness, I think, plays into this very, very strongly. And that one of the reasons I would argue that the U.S. political system has been less responsive is because, in general, we view the market outcomes as being fair, as kind of reflecting differential effort, intelligence, somewhat of a measure of a contribution to society. So our system is one that can kind of tolerate a fair amount of income inequality before people get upset. But one of the things I think has happened over the past 5 or 6 years, especially post financial crisis, is people have started to reconsider the extent to which a lot of the high incomes that were generated in the financial sector or in other parts of the economy were truly fair returns, that they were truly generated by, you know, hard work and contributions to the social welfare. So I think it's not surprising that voters don't react as negatively to Steve Jobs, someone, you know created a company, built a product that a lot of people use and find very helpful. And people on Wall Street or in the financial sector, for whom the connection between their wealth and the public good is a little harder to get your head around. So I think there has been a shift in the perceptions about fairness of inequality at the same time that income inequality has been rising.
Fritz, thanks so much for that call. Let's go to Madison next, where Claire joins us. Claire, good afternoon.
Hi, John. Thank you. This is very interesting because I have the exact opposite view from your previous caller. I think the very wealthy think that people that are on government assistance, for whatever reason, they're the takers. For example, you hear this catchphrase from Republican pundits quite frequently, free stuff. Like, all the people that need assistance are just a bunch of bums and they're looking for free stuff. Well, I really resent that. I see millions, for example, millions of Walmart workers working for minimum wage, and they are not making enough to survive. They're the people that need to get food stamps, for example. And, you know, if our minimum wage at least was decent, a living wage, maybe we wouldn't be having such a huge problem with income inequality.
Claire, thank you so much for that. Of course, Claire mentions Walmart. Their stock just took a huge hit here recently. Meanwhile, Costco continues to prosper.
So the caller brings up several interesting points. You know, one of course is that you know, part of the political discourse is obviously you know, who to blame for the inequality. Is it that the rich are doing things to make themselves rich at the expense of the poor, or the poor not upholding their end of the bargain? So that really sharply defines, I think the approaches of the two parties. The issue of minimum wage is an interesting one when it comes to, I think, the politics of income inequality. And I think the recent stories about Walmart kind of show a big part of the problem. You know, Walmart for many, many years was castigated for the low wages that it paid, suggesting that, you know, its profits were higher than they needed to be, and they could pay more. The recent experience, I haven't sorted through the data, suggests that, you know, after they did raise their wages, they've sort of suffered financially. So I think it suggests a couple of things to me. One is that it's probably not the case that people at the low end are not getting by because they're being exploited by their employers, but simply because, for whatever reason, the political dysfunctions that have been created, they sort of lack the skills to be productive enough to generate $10, $15 worth an hour of income. So a big area of political dysfunction in this country is the education system. And so part of the answer has to be, you know, some help from the government, some redistribution, subsidies for people whose wages work. But it also has to be some repair to the education system so that we ensure that we have people who can contribute $15 an hour or more worth to the economy so that they can work productively.
Of course, there's some discussion about who gets to determine what's $15 worth of work.
Yeah, that's right. So I mean, the standard economic story would be, well, the labor market would determine $15 worth of work. So I'm not saying that exploitation doesn't exist, but I think a big part of the problem is that the education system somehow been unable to kind of produce the types of workers that are going to be successful in the modern economy. And if we need to do two things, we need to fix the education system, and then we need to do things, wage subsidies and other supports for people at the low wage levels. But in a dysfunctional political system, a grand bargain such as education reform and welfare assistance and minimum wage or wage subsidies, is not being broached by the system.
And then there are a number, and we've had some examples. You pointed one out, but there are a number of persistent beliefs out there, and that's probably not the right way to put this. But and I'll just give you an anecdote. I was in a cafe the other day, and about two booths behind me, there was a gentleman loudly exclaiming that 90% of the homeless are homeless by choice. And I would venture a guess that opinion is shared by a number of people. And you've got others out there that are like that. Isn't that one of the challenges in dealing with the income inequality from an electoral politics point of view?
Oh, absolutely. There's been a lot written about, say, why lower income, lower to lower middle income people don't support redistribution. And I think the best explanation is that they believe that they will not be the beneficiaries, that people who are quote unquote undeserving will be the beneficiaries. So mm-hmm. Part of the politics of kind of fighting redistribution is to kind of create the perception of undeservedness and identify undeserving groups and point to them as the likely beneficiary.
Ronald Reagan's welfare queen.
That's the one example that's often used, is that, you know, there are people who have not worked hard, have not played by the rules, who are going to be the primary beneficiaries. Mm-hmm. You see this also of course, in the Affordable Care Act, discussions about whether or not undocumented aliens would be covered or not, because sometimes they're not deserving to be covered in the system and so forth. So there are lots of targets of this kind of undeservedness, portrait. But that's a big part of the discussions.
Okay. Let's take another call. We'll go to West Dallas this time, where Guy is with us. Guy, good afternoon.
Hi. My comment is, and they always say trickle-down economics. What about bubble-up economics? You know, in the past, they say trickle-down, the rich will make investments, but they make investments overseas. They don't invest in America anymore. Bubble-up economics, if they raise the minimum wage, that quarter more for a burger will be easily absorbed for most people, and then people will spend more money. They'll buy more cars. They'll buy more durable goods, washers, dryers, houses, and that means all the financial industries, everybody else, they'll make more money, and all that money bubbles up, and the rich get richer that way, but it gets shared amongst everybody. Wouldn't that be a feasible way of looking at it?
I think that's the central debate in economics now, is whether or not prosperity is generated by investment or by consumption. Obviously you need some of both. The concern about the investment not being made in the U.S. is an obvious one, and some people would say, well, if there were more consumption in the U.S., the investment would stay home, and so it's in favor of consumption. Without getting too far into the details, I would just say that the caller is absolutely right. That's kind of the central question people are grappling with, whether or not the government is a response to low economic. The thing we haven't really talked much about is that one of the reasons why income inequality has become more salient as a political issue is economic growth in the United States has been much lower for the past 20 years than it was from the 1940s to the 1970s. And so we, at the same time where incomes are getting more unequal, the average pie is growing less slowly. And so the debates about investment versus consumption, how to generate growth, and the effects of growth on income inequality are really a huge matter of dispute among economists and others.
We're in our third generation of trickle-down economics. Certainly we should have a verdict on whether it worked or not.
There are lots of reasons. Yeah, so there are lots of reasons. The counter-argument, of course, would be there are lots of reasons why growth has slowed in the United States, and it's slowed everywhere in Western Europe for the most part. So you can get into some pretty intense discussions about whether the U.S. growth rate has suffered because of the trickle-down economics approach versus some other things. And so, again, part of the political dysfunction is that people bring their predispositions to bear.
So
Republicans believe it's just lower taxes, less regulation will solve the problem, and Democrats want other interventions.
Well, we're almost out of time, and I wanted to be sure to get to what could be maybe the key question here. Okay, we've talked about the problem for the last 50-plus minutes. What, if anything, does your research show can be done about this? I mean, this is a pretty tough issue. Certainly, it's taken a long time to research. So did you find anything, any kind of suggested policy that could be undertaken? Or what needs to happen to fix this these two problems? If they're related, can they be fixed together? Or do we need to deal with one first and then the other?
It's very difficult because if you take where I'm coming from, which is that there's kind of a vicious circle between economic inequality and political polarization, it's hard to know how to break that circle. Obviously, you need policy interventions to deal with inequality or to boost growth or to alleviate poverty or any of these kind of social goals that we want to have, but because of income inequality, we have a dysfunctional politics, and because of dysfunctional politics, we can't solve them. So I'm a little short on solutions without some kind of fundamental changes in either the political structure or the economic structure. It's hard to see how to completely revert to something different. Another reason for somewhat pessimism is that oftentimes people look at the middle of the 20th century where we had less polarization in our political system, a more functional government, more economic equality, more growth, is the place we'd like to move back to. But I think it's important to remember is that was an unusual period of American politics.
Okay.
I think there are some things that we can do on the margins, but I don't see a magic bullet.
Well, the thing we need to do right now is stop, because we're out of time, but clearly we could do another hour on this. Professor, thanks so much for joining me this afternoon on the Kathleen Dunn Show. I really appreciate your time today.
Great, thank you.
Nolan McCarty is a professor of politics at Princeton University. Thanks to K.P. Whaley and to Michelle Good, who helped make this happen. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network.